It's a Merry Christmas in Kansas, a bad night for Nazis in Wisconsin, and Tim goes 1-for-2 in Minnesota. More primary colors on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Can Ayanna Pressley become another Ocasio-Cortez in Massachusetts? Or has she already left the building?
What's working against her is that the primary is the day after Labor Day. And honestly, there are not a huge amount of people who are actively engaged in this political race, and I think is among the challenges that she faces.
Plus, is President Trump the reason the Florida governor primary has turned into a runaway?
A year ago, everybody would have said Putnam would win. But he's not run a great campaign. His message has been sort of bland. But I think there are real doubts of whether he could have overcome Trump and the current anti-establishment climate in the Republican Party.
And we talked to a Reagan loyalist who ran Paul Laxalt's presidential effort.
I knew Paul quite well, as you know, and he was a great guy. And he was a loyal soldier.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 241 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. It was, for the most part, an Omarosa-filled week. You couldn't turn the channel without seeing the former Apprentice contestant slash Trump sycophant slash White House staffer turned former White House staffer slash sworn Trump enemy boasting of taping Chief of Staff John Kelly firing her in the Situation Room and saying she heard the tapes of President Trump using the N-word.
When he talks that way, the way he did on this tape, it confirmed that he is truly a racist.
And in response, we heard from Trump and other administration officials dismissing Ms. Manigault Newman as a liar and a publicity hound. In the reality TV program known as the Trump Presidency, it all amounted to, so what else is new? But then came this Trump tweet on Tuesday that's worth pointing out. Quote, when you give a crazed, crying lowlife a break and give her a job at the White House, I guess it just didn't work out. Good work by General Kelly for quickly firing that dog. Unquote. Yes, that came from the President of the United States. He really wrote that. Believe me, we'd love to not have to start our show with a Trump tweet, but this one is worth hearing, just in case people forget. The vice president was in the news this week with his plan that would create a U.S. military command for outer space.
This report calls for is the creation of an elite group of joint warfighters specializing in the domain of space, who will form the backbone of the nation's newest armed service, Space Operations Force. Just like our special operations forces, a space operations force will draw men and women from across the military and will grow into their own unique and cohesive community. They'll support the combatant commands by providing space expertise in times of crisis and conflict.
The military is said to be split on the issue, with some expressing concern about the ability of Russia and China to build anti-satellite weapons, while others worried about the cost. One thing I think we can all agree on is that there is no better time than now to play this song by Peter Dinklage from an old bit on Saturday Night Live.
Boys and girls, I think you'll find that my pen will blow your mind. Look at my pants with the eyes in your face. My legs are covered in outer space. Space pants. Space pants. I am wearing face pants.
Okay, I'll be honest. I always wanted to play this song on The Political Junkie, and the plan by Vice President Pence has given me an excuse. Thank you, Mr. Vice President. Okay, back to Earth, and to the latest primary results. Minnesota was one of four states that voted on Tuesday, and there were two results that got national attention. Keith Ellison, the left-wing congressman who was giving up his seat to run for attorney general, won the Democratic primary by a nearly 2.5-to-1 margin, despite being hit by a charge of domestic abuse by an ex-girlfriend in the weekend prior to the voting, a charge he denied. And in the closely watched race for governor, much of the focus was on the Republican primary. Tim Pawlenty, a former two-term governor, presidential hopeful, and Trump critic, was seeking a comeback, but he lost convincingly to Jeff Johnson, the party's 2014 nominee. The Democratic nod went to Congressman Tim Walz. In Wisconsin's first congressional district, the one being vacated by Speaker Paul Ryan, the candidacy of Paul Nehlen, who got national attention for his pro-Nazi and white supremacist views, went nowhere. He finished a poor third in the GOP primary. And some primary news out of Vermont. In the race for governor, Democrats nominated Christine Hallquist, the first transgender candidate for governor ever. The bizarre news, however, came from the Republican side. Brooke Page is leading in the GOP race to take on Senator Bernie Sanders, no biggie. But Page also won the primary for the at-large House seat, Attorney General, Secretary of State, State Auditor, and State Treasurer. He's likely to get clobbered in every race in November, but he's the Republican nominee for 5, maybe 6 statewide positions. I guess the real question is, how come he didn't run for lieutenant governor? And we have a result in Kansas, a week after the Republican gubernatorial primary there. Jeff Collier, the incumbent, had been locked in a tight primary with Kris Kobach, the Secretary of State, who was endorsed by President Trump. The margin was 210 votes, which grew to 345 votes, out of more than 313,000 cast. Collier conceded the race on Tuesday.
My dad, Jim Collier, told me, always put others ahead of yourself at all times. That's what this is about.
Back to Minnesota. The failure of Tim Pawlenty to return to the governorship leads to this week's trivia question. Who was the last former governor to regain his or her job after a period of absence? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
Those were the days, my friend. We thought they'd never end. We'd sing and dance forever and a day. We'd live the life we choose. We'd fight and never lose. Those were the days. Oh, yes, those were the days.
Of all the 200-plus Republicans in the House, he was the first.
We need to take our country back. We need to make America great again. We need to be a country where our children and grandchildren can live the American dream like many of us did. The leader is Donald Trump, and you're seeing his support surge. I was proud to be the first to endorse him in Congress.
Chris Collins was a GOP backbencher in Congress in his second term, when he decided to endorse Donald Trump for president in February of 2016. Since then, and especially since Trump's election, Collins has been in demand on cable TV and around the country to spread the Trump gospel. He represents the 27th District in Western New York, a GOP bastion that takes nearly all the areas between the Buffalo suburbs, the same district that elected Jack Kemp, and the areas southeast of Rochester. The 27th gave Trump his best showing by far in his home state, 59% of the vote. And it was Chris Collins' country as well. In his last two contests, he won more than two-thirds of the vote. But no more. Collins was arrested last week on insider trading charges. He's on the board of a biotech company, and when he learned that an experimental product to treat multiple sclerosis failed, he allegedly called his son, who then called his girlfriend and her parents, and they all unloaded their stock, avoiding hundreds of thousands of dollars in losses. The stock soon tanked. Collins says he expects to be exonerated and that the charges are meritless. And at first, he insisted he was going to seek a fourth term.
I will continue to work hard for the people and constituents of the 27th Congressional District of New York, and I will remain on the ballot running for re-election this November.
But with the writing on the wall, he changed his mind just days later. He said he would suspend his campaign, though he would not resign his seat. Randy Gorman is the news director for station WXXI in Rochester, New York, and has been following the story. Randy, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Enjoy being on with you, Ken. Thanks for calling me.
Well, 9 of the 27 congressional seats in New York are held by Republicans, but Collins seemed to be the most notable, given his reputation as the go-to Republican to talk all things Trump. Until his arrest, and you know this better than anybody, but it looked like he could keep that seat for as long as he wanted.
Really, that district is so Republican in terms of not just numbers, Ken, because it has about a 40,000 voter advantage right now in terms of the GOP enrollment edge. But really, it was gerrymandered back in 2012 or so before redistricting. It was actually the old 26th, then became the 27th. Now it is a very staunchly gerrymandered Republican district, very strongly Republican for Collins, popular there no matter. There had been talk about this issue with the Australian biotech over the last year or two. Did not seem to rattle at least people who were interviewed by the media, the party faithful. And as you mentioned, he was the first member of the House to endorse President Trump before he got elected and has been a staunch supporter of his. So really, up to now, it has been a very reliably Republican district. That's why this really throws things into a bit of turmoil here.
Well, a few years ago, we saw another a New York Republican, Michael Grimm of Staten Island. He got himself indicted. He stayed on the ballot, and he went on to win re-election. Could Collins have won again if he had he run again?
I would not be surprised, and not an exact parallel here, but we had a local member of the state assembly who had died by a suicide. Actually, this happened a couple of years ago, and he actually won the primary despite having died, and it ended up the party bosses in that case, and there are technical laws that allowed them in this case to nominate someone else to be on the ballot. I think that despite the indictment, it is very possible that Collins still would have been reelected, but they're trying to, they being the party hierarchy here in Western New York, trying to structure this in a way that they can still run somebody who they think can win reelection and be there next year. Because Collins, obviously, as you mentioned already, has said he's not going to actively seek reelection, but he cannot easily take himself off the ballot. And there's the rub.
Well, I'll get to the process of removing him from the ballot in a second, but I know that Fox News and other Trump supporters have accused the media of a double standard, that we all focused on Collins simply because of his backing of the president, and we ignored Democrats in similar positions. I want to play a little piece of tape from Tom Dupree, a former Bush administration official, who said this on Fox.
I understand there is relevance if, a congressman gets indicted. But what I don't understand is why they constantly try to make a link, saying either he's a friend of Trump or he's a supporter of Trump or he's known to associate with Republicans, because this doesn't have any connection to the alleged crime. If this was something where he was conspiring with other Republicans in the caucus, well, then maybe it's relevant. But just the fact that he engaged in what allegedly was kind of an insider trading stock scheme with, his son and some relatives or things like that, that has absolutely no relevance to his larger political connections or who he endorses for president.
Randy, does he have a point?
I guess to some extent you could say sure, but I'm looking at it from a journalist perspective, media perspective, in that you're trying to find some distinguishing elements to Chris Collins that has been notable about his career the last couple of years. One of the things that has been talked about a lot by national media, by local media, by Chris Collins himself, is how much he supports President Trump's positions and platforms and policies. And that has to be part, I think, of any story. Is it overdone a little bit? Perhaps. But I think it's all part and parcel of who Chris Collins is. And this district, which voted so reliably for President Trump back in 2016, Collins himself won very big as well, taking about 67% of the vote. I don't remember the percentage offhand for President Trump, but in that district, it was quite large over Hillary Clinton. So I think that has to be part of the conversation.
Okay, now the big question is, how does Collins get off the ballot?
Well, there are three different ways that he could
be taken off the ballot. One would be if he died, and obviously that's something that he doesn't want to do, I'm sure.
He's against that.
Another would be to move out of state, or another, the last way, which is the way that the Republican hierarchy is moving toward right now, is trying to see if he could run for another office. If he does not do one of those three things, he stays on the ballot right now. Apparently, the move to he does have residences in other states, including Florida, but there have been some questions about whether or not that would pass muster based on past court cases. So what the party here, the various eight county chairs in the different counties are working on is seeing if they can find some position that he could run for and probably not win, like a town position here, a clerk or whatever. And then they could run somebody else in his place. The problem is right now, Ken, is as far as I know and as far as other reports have indicated here in Western New York, there doesn't seem to be an open position. So they might have to have somebody, so to speak, fall on their sword for the party, maybe a small position in a town, say, hey, I decided I don't want to run for re-election or I want to quit my position, and then have Collins run for that. Then apparently, and again, this will be challenged by the Democrats, but the Republicans could try to put somebody in his place. That's really about the only way they can do that.
Although they would be kind of interesting, the thought of the Republican leaders putting Chris Collins, who is under indictment, who is under arrest, boosting him for another position.
Exactly. And there have been, of course, pundits and some little snarky comments by some columns and stuff saying, can you imagine if you're in your town, if you didn't want someone with his particular situation right now, you know, running to be your highway superintendent, whatever. But again, it's a little bit hypothetical right now, but Republicans say it's happened before. It's been used this way before. Democrats say, you know, we'll see you in court, basically. I mean, this is, I would say, almost definitely going to be headed to the courts just on the very basis that, you know, Democrats are trying to hold their Republicans' feet to the fire on this. And Republicans say, hey, you know, this has been done before. We think we can do it legally.
If they manage to get him off the ballot, who's a possible Republican replacement?
Well, that's an interesting conversation here. In Western New York, especially in the Buffalo area, there are several members of the New York State Legislature, both the State Assembly and the State Senate, who are interested. In fact, we've heard there have been as many as 15 candidates total. The problem with that is other dynamics come into play here, Ken. In the State Senate in New York, there's a very, very slim margin. Basically, Republicans run it by one vote or so right now. And the party would not be too crazy. The state party would not be crazy about having a state senator decide not to run for his or her position and then, you know, try to run for the Chris Collins position. There's also talk. There's been a colorful character you may have heard of here in Western New York, Carl Paladino, who's been a self-made businessman, been controversial for comments he made about the Obamas that were perceived as being racist. He was actually on the Buffalo School Board not too long ago, was removed for some other reasons regarding the way he had conveyed or released certain information that was supposed to be private. Colorful is perhaps a mild word to use for him. He's been kind of a firebrand here in this region, and he's got a lot of money. He might be one guy who will run for it. The problem, I think some people are looking at this, analysts are looking at this and saying, you know, is he too fiery? Is it taking too much of a chance to run him when there might be a large swath of people, even with as Republican an area as that district is, may not want to consider him. So they may go to somebody more tried and true, just look for somebody who's been in office before, comfortable running a campaign, but somebody who doesn't have, you know, quite the negative connotation that Carl has.
I also heard about the Erie County Comptroller as a possible candidate as well.
Right. Mahaliu, he's one of the first guys. Stefan Mahaliu came out last week, and he, in fact, some of his initial comments, again, very, and we talk about, you know, associating yourself with Trump, and that's pretty much what he did. He pretty much said, hey, if you bring, and he referred to the Democratic candidate, Nate McMurray, as being something along the lines of like a radical, you know, socialist, whatever. He came out right away, said he raised about $100,000 already. He says he's got some people who support him. We don't know exactly who. He may be one of the front runners at this point. But again, the various party chairs, they just actually met during this past week to kind of set up the process. And next week, they will likely start interviewing some of these candidates.
And when you say the process, basically, there's obviously not a primary. The nominee will be picked by these party leaders, correct?
Exactly. And of course, you know, people will complain about that. And I'm sure that the Democrats will be making noise about that as well. But, you know, that's the way it works, at least here in New York State, with this sort of a situation when you've got somebody who is not going to run actively and you're going to try to move him to a different position. The Democrats, it's interesting, before you and I spoke today, already had just sent out a press release complaining about the fact there had been a primary challenger for Collins back some months. And the party hierarchy managed to get him off the ballot. And they say, hey, you know, you've already had your primary and now you're going to handpick somebody. But, you know, if that's the process that stands up legally in court, you know, that's what they're going to use.
You mentioned Nate McMurray, who's the Democratic nominee. What do you know about him?
Green Island, which is off the Buffalo region, just off the border there, not too far away. I just covered him last week when all this broke over the last weekend. Personable guy. His positions are pretty progressive. I don't know everything about him in terms of, you know, his past policies, but again, because he's more of a local politician, but the positions that he was expounding, in fact, when I covered him, he was at a union hall and talking about something along the lines of universal health care. That's why the Republican Mahalio already, you know, painted him as a radical socialist sort of guy. He seems to be, as I say, a personable guy. He's not run for an office at this level before. And again, I think the numbers in the district would kind of be stacked up against him unless somehow the Republicans are stuck with somebody that either the general population doesn't want or some other kind of a situation arises. But at this point, just my initial thought is, while even the DCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, has indicated they're more interested in the race, there's been no indication, Ken, that they're going to pour a lot of money toward that, toward the situation here in the 27th district. I've heard that it said that the Democratic campaign, the Congressional Committee, really is kind of setting their sights on other districts that they think are more winnable than this one.
Randy Gorman is the news director for station WXXI in Rochester, New York, a station, I should point out, where you can hear the Political Junkie each week. Randy, it was great having you on the show.
Thanks. I really enjoyed it. Thanks a lot, Ken.
There are two primaries coming up, first in Florida on August 28th, then a week later in Massachusetts, that have captured national attention. The first one, in the Sunshine State, is for the Republican nomination for governor. The incumbent, Rick Scott, is term-limited and is running for the Senate. We'll focus on the Democratic congressional primary in Massachusetts in a few minutes. In Florida, the GOP battle to succeed Scott is between Adam Putnam, the state agriculture commissioner, and once considered the clear favorite, and Ron DeSantis, a very conservative congressman. But he has one thing Putnam does not have.
He's tough, he's smart, and he loves Florida, and he loves our country, and he's going to be your next governor, Ron DeSantis.
Since Trump's endorsement, DeSantis has jumped into a huge lead in the August 28th primary. We'll see what that endorsement means in November. But in a Republican contest, there's no contest. Trump's backing can be crucial. Adam Smith is the political editor for the Tampa Bay Times and writes The Buzz on Florida Politics. Adam, welcome back to the Political Junkie.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks for having me again.
Well, is this another example of Trump's popularity with Republican voters? Is it that simple?
Well, it's basically, yes, it is that simple. That Trump endorsement really meant everything in this race. You know, I think you throw in the fact that one of the candidates here, Adam Putnam, is a career politician and part of the establishment, and that played a big factor, too. That's kind of part and parcel of the Trump endorsement.
But if you had asked me not too long ago who was going to win, I would have said Putnam wins. And did he do anything wrong to lose his lead, or was the endorsement by Trump that crucial?
You know, I think if you'd ask most people that follow Florida politics really carefully a year ago, maybe even 6 months ago, everybody would have said Putnam would win. If you asked them 10 years ago, everybody would have said Putnam will win this governor's race.
When he started running, right? 10 years ago, right?
I think he started running about the time, a little bit after he came out of the womb. But he is a rising star and a charming, very smart, very policy-oriented guy who's been working the grassroots forever. And so he was he looked like a sure thing. And he's not run a great campaign. His message has been sort of bland. But I think the question would be, if he'd run a perfect campaign, if he'd run an A-plus, five-star campaign, I think there are real doubts of whether he could have overcome Trump and the current anti-establishment climate in the Republican Party.
Well, I want to play a commercial from DeSantis. that is either very creepy or it's very funny. I can't decide. It's narrated by his wife, Casey, and it cuts to the candidate with his children.
Everyone knows my husband, Ron DeSantis, is endorsed by President Trump, but he's also an amazing dad. Ron loves playing with the kids.
Build the wall.
He reads stories.
Then Mr. Trump said, "You're fired." I love that part.
He's teaching Madison to talk.
Make America great again.
People say Ron's all Trump, but he is so much more.
Big league. So good.
I just thought you should know.
Ron DeSantis for governor.
I mean, it is kind of funny, isn't it?
My bias is toward a political ad that you actually remember 30 seconds after watching it. So I think it's pretty funny.
Do you know something? Even before Trump's endorsement, how important was this in DeSantis's rise?
Representative Ron DeSantis, also a Florida gubernatorial candidate. Congressman DeSantis, good to have you with us.
And Congressman Ron DeSantis is with me now from the Hill. How are you, sir? And good morning to you. Thanks for spending time with us.
Joining me now, Congressman Ron DeSantis from the House Foreign Affairs Committee and former military.
Nonstop appearances on Fox News.
Yeah, I think that was an extraordinary thing in this race. And I think perhaps unprecedented in a campaign, in a high-profile campaign like this, where you had one candidate basically his campaign in effect being bankrolled by Fox News, because he was on TV at least every other day on average for the longest time. And that is worth, Florida is such a big state, 10 media markets. It's very, very expensive to introduce yourself to voters statewide. That amount of Fox News coverage, he's never talking about being a candidate. He's usually talking about how terrible this Russia investigation was. But that's worth many, many millions of dollars in exposure.
You know, I've heard some Putnam supporters saying that, you know, it's a lost cause and he should have dropped out of the race a while back and he should have planned for his future at a later date. Have you spoken to him about what's happened? Is he shell-shocked?
There was a Republican debate, I guess, about 2 weeks ago, and I think there was at least I had the thought that maybe Putnam would be pulling his punches, that maybe he viewed, like a lot of the conventional wisdom is, that the race is virtually over and that it wouldn't do him any good for the future to really pummel Ron DeSantis. But that's not what happened. He went at DeSantis very hard. So I haven't seen Adam Putnam in a couple weeks, but I suspect they still think there's a shot here. And I hate to be one of those people that thinks the race is all over. The last time I said that was the day after the Access Hollywood tapes, and I thought that the race was all over. So anything can happen.
Yeah, we all thought the same thing. And I wonder what's the difference between Trump's role in the primary. I mean, he may put DeSantis over the top on August 28th, but what does that mean for November? What is Trump's role then, and how would it play in Florida?
Well, I think that's fascinating. I mean, obviously, the old rule of thumb is if you're in a Republican primary, run to the right in a primary, run to the center in the general election. But, you know, that ad you just played, and the way he's run his campaign about all Trump all the time, you can't distance yourself from the president at all. Now, I think there's a school of thought that the president is going to motivate the Republican base just as much as the anti-Trump sentiment is going to motivate the Democratic base. But we'll see. I mean, one thing DeSantis has not done at all is been willing to step up and talk about what he actually wants to do for Florida and how he feels about Florida issues. He is almost exclusively talking about national issues. So maybe he'll have some attempt once he starts putting some meat on the bones of his actual agenda. Maybe there'll be some attempt to sound like a centrist, but we'll see.
Let me ask you one quick question on the Senate race. It's Governor Rick Scott against Senator Bill Nelson in November. Everybody seems to count Scott out before the election, but he always seems to fool the experts. What are you looking for?
Well, I think both Rick Scott and Bill Nelson are two things. One, they are both consistently underestimated. And two, they're both very boring candidates, plain vanilla candidates. But Scott has spent so much more money, him and his allies, pounding Bill Nelson. And that race is still 3 or 4 points within the margin of error race. So there's a lot of chatter that I hear that Bill Nelson is in deep, deep, deep trouble. And there's no question this is going to be the toughest race of his career. But he's a lot more formidable than people give him credit for.
Adam Smith is the political editor for the Tampa Bay Times. Adam, it's going to be an amazing political year in Florida. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Ken.
A week after Florida comes primaries in Massachusetts on September 4th. There's a Democratic contest to pick an opponent for Governor Charlie Baker, a Republican who does very well with Democratic voters. But there's national attention on a House race in the 7th District. Michael Capuano, a reliably liberal Democrat first elected in 1998, is facing an unexpected primary from Ayanna Presley, an African-American city councilor from Boston, whose candidacy began to pick up steam when this happened, as told by MSNBC's Chris Hayes.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a 28-year-old former bartender, community organizer, Bernie Sanders supporter, working-class New Yorker, as she calls herself, and Democratic socialist. A woman who ran one of the most incredibly impressive campaigns, honestly, in recent memory, to pull off the biggest upset in congressional politics since Tea Party candidate David Bratt defeated Republicans' House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. She defeated Congressman Joe Crowley, a 10-term incumbent, the number 4 Democrat in the House.
If Ocasio-Cortez, a self-proclaimed Democratic socialist, a previously unknown candidate vastly outspent by her opponent, if she can topple the fourth-ranking Democrat in the House, what's to stop Presley from knocking off Capuano? Presley is the next Ocasio-Cortez, right? Capuano is the next Joe Crowley, right? Well, maybe not. Anthony Brooks is a senior political reporter for WBUR in Boston. And he'll tell us about the similarities and differences between the two primary races. He's also an old friend. We worked together years ago at NPR. Anthony, it's wonderful having you on The Political Junkie.
Hey, Ken, it's great to be here.
Well, there have been, as you know, tons of comparisons between what happened in New York's 14th District with what might happen next month in Massachusetts 7. I mean, I know that both are Democratic primaries with women of color challenging male incumbents. But there are differences, right?
Yeah, I think there are big differences. I mean, you know, in this era of politics, Ken, you know that making predictions is kind of a risky business. But, I mean, what I would say about this race is, first and foremost, Michael Capuano is not Joe Crowley. And I'll get to that in a second. And I also think that there are big differences between Ayanna Presley and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I mean, first of all, Capuano is not a kind of party regular high up in the system. You know, he's a scrappy, street-smart, progressive Democrat. He's part of the Progressive Caucus. He's also not taking this race for granted at all. And a big difference between him and Crowley, for example, is Capuano actually shows up for debates with Ayanna Presley. But, you know, I think he's pretty popular. Our latest polling shows him with a 13-point lead. Obviously, that can change. The same polling shows that Ayanna Presley does better among black voters and younger voters. So that's really what she has to focus on, is getting those people to come out to the polls. And as she says, really activating a new generation of voters. But what's working against her, besides Capuano's popularity and a really effective sort of get-out-the-vote operation, is that the primary is the day after Labor Day. And honestly, even up until this point, there's not a huge amount of people who are actively engaged in this political race and getting them really fired up. The day after Labor Day, when people are just returning from vacations, I think is among the challenges that she faces.
Well, you know, one thing you said that struck me, you mentioned that unlike Joe Crowley in New York, Capuano has shown up for debates. Let me play, you know, we keep talking about that Well, you know, he may not be loud or demonstrative, but he's certainly one of the most liberal members of Congress. Let me play a little piece of tape of Capuano debating Presley earlier this month.
I still live in the same two-family house just a few blocks from where I grew up. That's why I know, with Donald Trump in the White House, we are in the fight of our lives. He's threatening everything we care about, from health care to the environment, to a woman's right to choose, Social Security, and Medicare. My efforts to stop the Trump agenda have been recognized by many national, well-known, and well-respected independent groups.
And Anthony, you also mentioned the fact that Presley's trying to, you know, the key to her success is getting out the black vote. But Capuano has the endorsements of John Lewis and the Congressional Black Caucus. So she has a lot going against her.
Yeah, it's true. What impresses me about her race is she's sort of put her finger on one of the defining issues of our time, and that is economic disparity. The 7th District in Massachusetts, it's the state's only majority-minority district. It's also a district with the highest rates of economic disparity. And you can take a bus from Harvard Square in Cambridge down to Dudley Square in the heart of Roxbury, which is the heart of Boston's African-American community. And, you know, the contrast between the average income and the wealth gap is just huge. And she's trying to focus on that. And I think that's a laudable issue to put the spotlight on. The trouble is I'm just not sure she has yet made the case as to what she can do as a member of Congress that would be substantially different than what Capuano does and the issues that he supports. She talks about building a movement and that she wants to be a sort of agent of change. And in this era, that may be a message that resonates. But the problem is you still have the fact that Capuano is very popular, and there isn't any difference between them on any issues. I mean, they all share this. The only issue that they sometimes go back and forth about is Presley is one of the people who says that we should abolish ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. And Capuano says, why abolish it? Let's just change the policy. But I don't think that's something that is really, you know, a defining issue that's going to excite the voters. And they're both coming at the problem from the same kind of far left of center point of view. So in a way, Capuano is still very suited for this district. And I think Presley is going to be hard-pressed to make a case to throw out this 10-term congressman who has been, up until now, very, very popular.
Well, you know, I was watching the debate, and of course Capuano will say that, you know, it seems like they, as you say, they will probably vote the same. But I think the argument that Presley is trying to make is that it's far more than just a voting record. Here's some of what she said.
I've dedicated my life to eradicating and addressing issues of income inequality, the wealth and wage gap, structural racism, and gun violence. All issues that are worsening and deepening under our current administration. But truth be told, for the residents of the 7th Congressional District, these systemic inequalities existed long before that man occupied the White House. The 7th Congressional District is one of the most diverse districts, and yet it is also one of the most unequal in this delegation and perhaps even in our country. I'm running because this district deserves, and these times require, bold activist leadership, a vote, a voice, and a partner.
Yeah, and Ken, what's interesting about that argument that she's making, what she goes on to say is these issues of economic disparity, of gun violence, of big problems in, you know, predominantly Boston's minority communities, but also minority communities in greater Boston, have been with us for a long time, and they were there and worsening even when the Democrats had control of Congress, even when Barack Obama was in the White House. So her point is this goes beyond just opposing Trump or being just a reliable liberal vote, as Capuano is. She gets back to this idea as, you know, I want to be part of this vanguard, this movement of change and movement builder. So that's the argument that Ayanna Presley is trying to make between now and primary day.
Have you seen any difference on the ground or, you know, with the candidates or with the voters since Ocasio-Cortez won her primary in New York? And the reason I ask that question, it just seems like I don't think I even heard of Presley's name until that shocker in New York, and Presley's name has now been mentioned more prominently nationally.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be hard-pressed to say the average voter has somehow been energized. I mean, I just don't know. I don't have a way of weighing that. But if you talk to her prominent supporters, I'm thinking of some members of the black clergy in Boston who are behind Ayanna Pressley. They point to what happened in New York and Ocasio-Cortez's victory. I mean, they'll point to the Pressley and Capuano race and say this is sort of the next race that is the contest for the soul of the Democratic Party. And maybe they're right. I mean, again, I think I've been offering some evidence that I believe this race is very different from the Crowley-Ocasio-Cortez race. But they're certainly trying to make that argument. Now, when you ask Pressley straight out, you know, do you think that because Ocasio-Cortez won that you can win, and are you the next Ocasio-Cortez? She's more careful. She's cautious. I mean, she doesn't sort of, I think she's happy to be asked that question. But if you ask her that question, she says, no, you know, this is a different district. These are different candidates. These are a different set of issues. She doesn't sort of willingly or enthusiastically embrace it, even though I'm sure she's happy to be associated with it. But there's another key difference between Pressley and Ocasio-Cortez, and that is Ocasio-Cortez was waiting tables, you know, 2 or 3 months before she won that primary that's going to send her to Congress. Ayanna Pressley is a professional politician. I mean, she's been on the city council for 3 terms. She's the top vote-getter. She's a good politician. She's good on her feet, but she's polished. And so that's a big difference between her and Ocasio-Cortez, because I think Ocasio-Cortez could really argue that she was truly the outsider against the true insider Democratic Party machine guy. Pressley can't make that case of herself, and it's a hard case to make against Capuano as well.
I should know the answer before I ask this question, and I just thought of it now, but there's never been a person of color in the Massachusetts House delegation, correct?
There has not. Well, no, in the House delegation, no. I was thinking of Senator Edward Brooke, of course, but in the House delegation, no, there has not.
So, I mean, that almost makes Pressley's case that it's time for kind of diversity in a changing district and a changing nation.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the interesting back and forths they had in the debate was Capuano argues in favor of experience, and he points to some key legislators in Massachusetts, like Senator Ed Kennedy, and says, look, when Senator Ted Kennedy got into the Senate, he wasn't a very good legislator, but it took him years to learn how to do it, and then he became a great legislator. And so he's arguing by the same token, his experience matters. Capuano argues that he's an effective congressman and that after 10 terms, he's learned how to do it. And Pressley sort of responds that this seat was once held by John F. Kennedy, was once held by Tip O'Neill. This is a seat that, you know, really meant something not only to Massachusetts and the greater Boston area, but to the nation as well. And so it should be the seat that continues to pioneer and forge new ground, and becoming the first African-American from Massachusetts to go to Congress would certainly be part of that tradition. So I think that's kind of a powerful and inspiring argument for her to make as well. We'll see if the voters respond on primary day.
Well, there's fewer than 3 weeks to go. What's your guess?
I'll give you a guess, but I want to give the preamble that in this day, I'm just so weary of predictions because we've been surprised by so much in the last 2 years. But, you know, my hunch is that Capuano holds on to this seat for the reasons that I've listed. I just think it's a tough case to make to throw this guy out. He's a scrappy neighborhood guy from Somerville, which is just outside of Boston. He speaks the language. He sounds like he's from this area. He's in the streets. He's got a good campaign operation. I think he's going to get the vote out. He understands that he's facing a challenge, and I think he's taking it really seriously. Pressley has managed to raise some real money, but Capuano is ahead of her by a factor of 2 or 3. And so, yeah, I think he has the advantage of incumbency, and I think he's going to hold on.
Anthony Brooks is a senior political reporter for WBUR in Boston. Anthony, my friend, it's great to hear your voice again.
Ken, my friend, it's great to be here. Thank you so much. It's taken me so long to get
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, before Jeff Collier in Kansas, who was the last unelected Republican governor to be toppled in a primary? The answer, Walter Miller. The South Dakota Republican became governor in 1993 when the incumbent, fellow Republican George Mickelson, died in a plane crash. But Miller lost the GOP primary to keep his job the following year to a former governor, Bill Janklow. And the randomly selected winner is Steve Davis of Laramie, Wyoming. Steve wins the coveted political junkie button. And don't forget, we still have a scuttlebutton puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com.
You tell the whole darn world, if you don't happen to like it, deal me out. Thank you kindly, pass me by. Pass me by.
Most Americans probably never heard of Paul Laxalt, but Ronald Reagan certainly did. The president was quite effusive about his friend Paul Laxalt in 1986 in a salute to the retiring senator from Nevada.
The friend who understands you creates you, a wise man once said. Paul created because he always understood, and for that I am and shall always be grateful. But I'm humbled, too, knowing that so often he chose to give of himself. For Nancy, for me, and always for America, his sweet promised land. So yes, I owe a great deal to Paul Laxalt. But how really does that make me any different from everyone else in this room and every other man, woman, and child who enjoys the blessing of freedom in this wonderful country tonight?
Laxalt died earlier this month, 4 days after his 96th birthday. He served 2 terms in the Senate and before that, 1 as governor. Equally significant, he was considered Ronald Reagan's best friend in the Senate, a close advisor and honest counsel. He was with Reagan in the 1976, 1980, and 1984 presidential campaigns. As a senator, he was never known for sponsoring legislation or giving riveting speeches. But when he did speak, for example, insisting in 1986 that it was time for Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos to leave office, people noticed. And he always had the president's ear. He also hoped to become the 1988 Republican nominee for president, running as Reagan's heir apparent. Here he is in March of 1987, announcing the formation of an exploratory committee.
Running for president, to say the least, is an awesome venture. In my own case, I have a full and keen realization of what it's like to run for the highest office in the land. Having been at Ronald Reagan's side as his chairman in 3 presidential campaigns. After extended discussions, my wife Carol and I have decided to go forward. In focusing these past few weeks on these matters, I simply could not get away from 2 very important words, duty and obligation. In Western parlance, my friends, this hired hand is ready to take over as foreman.
But ultimately, with Reagan's vice president, George Bush, also in the race, along with conservative favorite Jack Kemp, it was hard to get traction or raise money. He was out of the race by August. His campaign was run by Jerry Carmen. Carmen was the owner of tire stores in Manchester, New Hampshire, who became the state Republican chair and then the architect of Reagan's victory in the crucial 1980 primary. For his service, he was appointed head of the General Services Administration. I knew Jerry Carmen quite well back in the 1980s when I was with ABC News, and he would regale me with the greatest political stories from his career in New Hampshire politics. And I mean the greatest. I don't believe I've spoken to him in the past 30 years, but when I heard about Laxalt's passing, his was the first name I thought of. And I tracked him down. Jerry Carmen, my old friend, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Well, thank you. It's too bad it took 30 years, right?
I know. Well, you know, something. I mean, you know, I was busy. You know, I had to clean my room and, you know, all those things. But I heard a rumor that you're 88 years old. Is that possible?
Just turned 88. I think it's impossible, actually. And Well, my legs are a little bit impaired. From the waist up, I feel like I could get back into Laxalt's campaign.
Well, you know, as I told you, you were the first person I thought of when I heard about Paul's death. Tell me your memories of him.
Well, you know, there's a little bit before that, because in the 1980 campaign, we had gone through 76, of course, and there were a lot of hard feelings at various people that didn't come along or broke away when they should not have.
You're talking about Reagan's challenge to Ford.
Yeah, at 76, you know, Paul was chairman then, and Senator was chairman, and you know, that was a campaign that almost made it, and also made a lot of hard feelings in people. But we went through it, and we went through 76, which he was the chairman, and what a lot of people didn't realize, most of us, or a lot of us, wanted him to be the vice presidential candidate. He came from Nevada, which was a state known for gambling, prostitution, and some other stuff. And in the final evaluation, the team decided that they couldn't have two Western candidates, and that the other thing was the state he came from. It was unfortunate, frankly. I don't want to labor this point, but we took Bush for vice president, and that really ended the political drive between what was the Western or renovation, modernization of the Republican Party that Reagan brought in. Bush was entitlement, establishment, and so forth. So Ronald Reagan always said that Bush, nobody could ask for a better vice president than George Bush at the end of his two terms. It ended the Ronald Reagan period.
Now, but, you know, there was an impressive bunch of candidates who were running that year. There was Bush, there was Bob Dole, there was Jack Kemp. You could throw in Pete DuPont and Pat Robertson, but you had a pretty strong Republican field. It would have been hard to break through with that crowd, no?
It would have been probably impossible, okay? But it probably was impossible to be president anyway, because at our first press conference, where we had briefed the senator on what we thought he should say and how he should go and so forth, and what not to get into, which is really important. You know, one thing, Ken, about politicians, they have a hump on their back. I used to call it that. So if you ask them a question that involved that hump, instead of ignoring it, they'd go on forever trying to explain it. And right out of the box, they asked Paul about, I think Paul signed a bill in Nevada that legalized prostitution and did some other gambling things. And they went into that, and he must have taken a half hour on that question, really used up all of, he used to be in the business, so you know. So we used up really, but all of his really good press time on that one question. And never, he used to try to explain it like that if you came from in Nevada, the textile business was your business, became Nevada, gambling was your business. So you try to explain it away like that. You could tell by the end of the press conference that it was going to be a tough row.
There was always the complaint, there was always the rub that Laxalt was not, shall we say, the hardest working member of the Senate. But how was he as a candidate? Did he have that fire in the belly to be president?
You know, as a campaign worker or chairman, but he never got into details. So, I mean, when you're running a campaign, you don't want the titular head of the campaign bothering you, okay? So when they say he's lazy, he wasn't necessarily lazy, but he it wasn't into those details, which I thought was great, frankly.
Well, I remember, I mean, another thing I remember about him is that he and Reagan, I mean, loved each other, but he never, I mean, I don't know if this is a fair thing to say, but he never seemed to have Reagan's presence or charm. I mean, obviously, there was only one Ronald Reagan.
No, I was really a little amazed at that, because everybody would, you know, they worked together from the West. They were governors at the same time. They were good friends. And also philosophically, about the conservative issues and so forth, they were really both together. And so that wasn't a problem, but he wasn't really like Reagan. And the press, for some reason, sort of made them twins. But Paul was much different. I mean, Paul was much tougher than when you dealt with him than Reagan was. Reagan had a different way about him. I can remember a difference I had with Reagan, President Reagan, on something. And, of course, I was told by his chairman what the decision was, I think by Bill Casey and Ed Meese, and I didn't like the decision. So I said, I want to hear it from the governor himself at the time. So I went in his office, and I couldn't believe how nice he handled me, but didn't change his mind. So Paul was a little different. If I went into Paul's office as senator or work campaign and that we had a disagreement, it would be a disagreement. I mean, we would be arguing and probably the language wouldn't be that great and so forth, and it would be a little heated. You never got that from the president. So they were nothing alike to deal with.
What did you find to be the toughest roadblock in running the campaign?
The campaign came along pretty good, actually. It was the candidate himself. From covering these people, they either have it or they don't. And frankly, he didn't have the stomach for it. I remember when he decided he went up to the mountain at home. He has a home up on top of a mountain in Nevada. And his assistant calls me that night and says, the senator has decided not to run. Please tell the people that are out, the campaign people and so forth, and several of his very close friends that were there at the campaign headquarters at the time. And I said, you've got to be kidding. And he said, no, he's thought about it, and he's not going to run. And I said, well, I'd like to talk to him. He said, well, there's no phone up there. And then he asked me again to tell the campaign workers it was over. And I said, look, I'm not telling them that. You tell them to get on the phone. Come down here, or the phone, come down and use it, and tell these people himself, which he did. So about 30 minutes later, I got a phone call. We put him on the speaker, and he announced the campaign was over. So that's a little story about him.
I remember telling you 30 years ago that you have to write a book because you had, I mean, some of these stories can't be repeated now, but you had the best political stories that I've ever heard from anyone. Any chance you're going to write a book?
Well, I thought about it. I'm getting a little old for it. People have always said that to me, but I always had, as you know, the stories I told were always sort of funny or humorous. I never quite got to feel my friends that were in government with me that we saved the world, you know? Book after book, I could write about Ronald Reagan easily and dealing with him and working with him. I was always proud that he used to say that he wouldn't have been president, but for me, I knew it wasn't true, but I loved hearing it, you know? I was privileged, I think. That is a privilege. I think I had a White House pass for 2 years, and after that, many times I'd go in and talk to the president no note taker. No, at first, you know, usually when you're talking to the president of the United States, somebody's there taking notes so you don't misquote him and so forth. But I go in and just talk to him, just he and I, and we talk like I'm talking to you. I don't know, I don't want to take a lot of your time, but I don't know. I think when you come from New Hampshire, we think the government works for us. And, like, if you want to go see the governor of New Hampshire, I think it's the same, young Sununu's here, you'd go up to the Capitol, you'd walk up the stairs or take a rickety airport elevator. It's easier to walk up the stairs. You walk into the governor's office. There may be one policeman there that's usually a driver, but nobody else. You can say to the secretary, I'd like to see the governor. And if he's in, chances are he'd see you. When I look back, you talk about writing a book. When I look back and think of the privileges that I had, I see these people now who go in the White House like somebody just quit and is raising hell about everything. I wandered around the White House. I used to go and talk to Jim Baker. I talked to Ed Meese. I talked to Ed Harper, whoever had a job that was there, Judge Clark, who I didn't know as well as the others. Certainly I could have written a book, you know, then, really, just 30 years ago, or now 20-something years.
How about this? If you're not going to write a book, I'll just come over to your house and you'll tell me more stories. Is that okay?
Oh, I'll buy you lunch. I'm 88 years old. I can't find anybody that hasn't heard my stories before. So it'd be a pleasure.
I am definitely going to take you up on this.
I have younger guys like you. I tell them to raise their hand when they've heard it before, okay?
Jerry Carman is the former Republican state chairman of New Hampshire, who was the architect of Ronald Reagan's 1980 primary victory in the Granite State. In 1987, he managed the presidential exploratory effort of Paul Laxalt, the former governor and senator from Nevada, who died earlier this month. Jerry, it was wonderful hearing your voice again.
I'm serious about lunch. I'll give you a call.
Okay, if you're paying, I'll be there.
Okay, thanks, Kim.
Memories like the corners of my mind. Misty watercolor memories of the way.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
What's too painful to remember? We simply choose to